You know, I'm going to change the order because it makes perfect sense next. It's a great segue to have you present, Peter, about what makes, you know, your book and your work and what makes things funny. Everybody, Peter McGraw.
You're lucky you don't have to follow that. So I actually spend a lot of time with comedians, and one of the things that I've learned is that it's really important to get a laugh right away, hence the sweater vest. So I'm really happy to be here. I think it's just excellent happenstance that you heard the Colorado Matters talk. And I put together some ideas that I'd like to talk about that's specific to the topic today. And I think that it might provide a nice, useful framework for us as we have a conversation about the benefits of laughter. And then I think also, anytime that you talk about the benefits, you also have to talk about the risks, about the what comes with, sort of, well, I mean, we just finished a talk about nails in the head, so we're dancing on that line already. So what I want to do is talk about what humor is and then talk about some of the implications for coping, for living a better, healthier, happier life. And so I have a tendency to think about humor first and not laughter, and I'll tell you why. So I define humor as a psychological response, and it has three components. So the first component is a judgment, is a cognitive one. Hey, that's funny. Hey, she's funny, right? So this recognition, this cognitive recognition that a situation is, as we call it, funny. What's interesting about that is we often know when something's funny, but we don't know why it's funny, and I hope to be able to tell you that tonight. The second component is an emotional one, this positive feeling that we have, this feeling of delight that we usually call amusement, or what some scholars might call mirth. But, you know, something's amusing and we have that positive. I know, mirth, it's a weird word. I try not to say it. And then lastly, it has this behavioral component, this notion of laughter, this sort of perplexing behavior that we have. And I'm reluctant to just talk about laughter because not all laughter is suggestive of a humorous response. That is that all laughter is not accompanied by a judgment, hey, that's funny, and all laughter doesn't accompany this positive emotion, this amusement. So we have some conscious control over our laughter, so sometimes we'll laugh to be polite, like when our boss tells a bad joke, or there's this sort of overlearned, mindless laughter that people have incorporated into their conversation, where they'll punctuate a sentence with a little bit of laughter, and that both forms of that laughter is called what we call non-Duchenne laughter. So it's laughter that doesn't suggest that there's a positive emotion. The laughter that I was just enjoying is accompanied by amusement and is accompanied by saying, hey, that was really funny. Now, the question is, what causes this? Why is it that we have these kinds of reactions? And This is an old question. This is a question that goes back 2,500 years. As I've been trying to crack the humor code, one of the things that I realized early on is that there's a lot of people way smarter than me who have tried to answer this question. So Plato and Aristotle, Thomas Hobbes, Immanuel Kant, Sigmund Freud, all of these are Mark Twain. These are way smarter than I am, and I happen to boast one tool that they don't have, and that's the experiment, the scientific method, right? And that's the only thing that I can really bring to the table that these great minds didn't have. And so, the question is, what makes things humorous? What causes us to say that's funny, delight, experience amusement, and then laugh to indicate that? And I'm not proud to say this, but I stumbled on this question about 6 years ago, and I did something that my undergraduate students do when I give them a research project. I Googled it. And I'm glad I did, because I learned about all these classic theories, the theories of Aristotle and Plato and of Freud and Kant and Hobbes and so on. But I also learned about this little cited paper by a linguist named Thomas Veitch. And I had recruited a very bright graduate student. We sat and we read this paper. We spent hours reading this paper. And to us, this was a much better explanation than anything that had been presented before. And what this graduate student, Caleb Warren, and I set about doing is adding a bunch of psychology to it and started to run some studies and started to test that idea. And the idea is a simple one, but a little bit counterintuitive. That humor arises from potentially negative experiences, from things that are threatening, amiss, or wrong in some way. Now, this is peculiar in a sense, because something that we pursue with such passion that influences our lives, that we look for in our friends and lovers and our coworkers, that we pursue on a Friday night at a comedy club or watching a sitcom, that we hope to have a little bit of it in a staff meeting, may actually come from something negative. But Mark Twain realized this in one of my favorite quotes from him, where he said that the secret source of humor is not joy, it's sorrow. There is no humor in heaven. So I hate to break it to you. Heaven is a wonderful place, it's a delightful place, it's a perfect place. But because there's nothing wrong, there's nothing to make jokes about. Now, of course, the things that are wrong, amiss, or unsettling, what we call violations in our theory, don't normally make us laugh. As Twain said, they make us cry, they disgust us, they offend us, they make us uncomfortable. That there has to be something else there. There has to be a situation that helps make that violation, as we say, benign, make it safe, acceptable, or okay in some way. So, for instance, calling your mother an obituary is both wrong, yet technically okay. Can't get in trouble for it. And so when you start looking at the things that are funny, amusing, and that we laugh at, you can find these two conditions. You can find benign violations. So if you think about play, like rough and tumble play, slapstick, and tickling, they all have these two elements. They're a harmless attack. They're an attack that's not meant to hurt. But you can also see how those attacks can go awry. So in the case of tickling, for instance, when is it that tickling elicits laughter? It's only when it's done in a way that's not too aggressive, in a way that, when done by someone you trust. If you trust the person too much, like yourself, you can't tickle yourself and elicit that kind of reaction. There's no violation there. There's nothing threatening about that situation. Similarly, if on your way home tonight, a creepy guy in a trench coat came up and did a little tickling, there's nothing okay about that. There's nothing benign about that. And you get the negative reactions that come from that violation. You scream, punch him in the nose, call 911. So this idea of benign violations, I think, fits very nicely for these physical forms of humor. And as was mentioned at the beginning of this, we're not the only mammals to experience it. So non-human primates, apes, chimps, bonobos, and so on, react in much the same way, in play fighting and tickling. And there's really fascinating research that we discovered during our Humor Code project that these very same situations occur with rats. So it's controversial to call it rat laughter. And so I don't, but in these laboratories, you can, not you, but the researchers who the rats know and are comfortable with, will sort of tickle and roughhouse with the rats, and they emit these ultrasonic chirps that are associated with positive emotion or positive affect in these rats. And so if the attacks become too aggressive, these chirps change to the kind of chirps or the kinds of vocalizations that rats have when they fight, when they're attacking another. And what's really fascinating about it is that at some point the rats learn to pursue this. So then the researchers will put their hand into the cage and the rats will chase after it and pursue humor in the same way that we go to a comedy club. And I think that this is really compelling evidence for this. Now, of course, physical forms of comedy, they may be the most universal, but they're not the only things that we laugh at. The world of violations for humans is quite broad. The things that can go wrong in the world are numerous, are vast, right? So you can have violations of linguistic conventions, so the kind of wordplay and puns. Who here likes wordplay, puns? Yeah, nerds like wordplay and puns, right? And why is that the case? Well, because nerds, people who care about language, can recognize what's gone wrong, and they can also recognize, by the same token, what is going right. And then that also indicates this idea that nerds care about language. So it increases the threat and the arousal of it. And so when you think about what we started with is this idea of you recognize that something is a benign violation. You say, oh, that's funny. You delight in it, because when you take something that's negative and you switch it to something that's okay, now you have this positive experience, something that Freud recognized when he talked about relief theory. And so, and that helps explain why this is a positive emotional experience. And then lastly, you laugh to tell other people that this potentially threatening situation is actually okay. So laughter serves a communicative function. So in the case of play fighting, for instance, it's the person or the animal being attacked that does most of the laughing. It says that this is okay, I recognize you're not really trying to hurt me. And when you think that you are, that person is, the laughter goes away and is replaced by curse words oftentimes. So here we have a model, an idea about what underlies humor and why it has these three components. It also explains the risks associated with comedy, with trying to make people laugh, with trying to amuse them, is that you can fail, and that you can fail in one of two ways, right? The benign way, tickle yourself, or the purely violating way, that creepy stranger in the parking lot. The good news, though, is that the model also provides a suggestion about the two ways that humor attempts can succeed. And I think that this is really quite relevant for tonight's conversation. So one way that we talk about in the Humor Code is we call it the Seinfeld strategy. So Jerry Seinfeld, you know, one of the most popular comedians today, he takes the seemingly benign situations, the things that are sort of normal in the world, and points out what's wrong with them. Right? So he's engaged in observational comedy. So he has jokes. One of my favorite jokes about Jerry Seinfeld, he's talking about buying socks. He has to buy socks, and he's like, what is it with the little hangers? Do I need those hangers? So something we've all done hundreds of times, we've bought socks and never thought about those hangers, and he points out what's so strange about those hangers. And what's very nice about Jerry Seinfeld's form of comedy is that when he fails, he may bore you, right? He's failed to create a sufficient enough violation there. The other strategy we call the Silverman strategy, after Sarah Silverman. So Sarah Silverman is a very funny woman, less popular than Jerry Seinfeld, and her lack of popularity relative to him makes sense, because what she does is she starts with the violations in the world. She starts with these really, really bad things, and then she finds a way to make them okay, to make them benign in some way. She often does this by kind of putting them to a fun song or sort of saying them in a non-threatening way. The problem with Sarah Silverman is that when she fails, she commits a hate crime. And as a result, really upsets people. And I think that when it comes to the notion of how humor, how laughter enhances our life, there's a long history of people being able to take the things that are wrong in the world and finding a way to make them okay. So for instance, my co-author Joel Werner and I went to Palestine to look for humor in places that you'd least expect it. And our friends were like, sure, Palestine's gonna be hilarious. And it actually was. So anytime you can find people who are in troubled situations, who are able to cope with that difficult situation, or who are looking for a way to criticize the people who have placed them in that situation, you're going to find comedy. So you're going to find it as a way to cope and a way to critique. And there's a long history of both of those things. So the last thing that I'll end with is this issue of why humor helps. And I'll connect it to this benign violation approach. So first of all, the research on the benefits of humor with regard to health has a long way to go. There's a lot of research that still needs to be done in the behavioral sciences and medicine and so on. But there's very good reason to believe. There's very good theory behind this. So the first reason is that because humor is this positive emotional experience, and it's very clear that positive emotion helps us in our lives. So it helps us be more creative, and it helps us deal with the stresses and strains of being human. And so the happier we are, the better buffeted we are against the pain and stress and adversity of life. And the second reason is that a good sense of humor helps rally people around us. So a good sense of humor is one of the most valued characteristics in a friend and life partner. And if you think about it, having a partner who has a good sense of humor is really beneficial. So one is that they make you laugh, right? They help create positive emotion. The fact is that if you both laugh at the same things, it's often indicative that you see the world in the same way, that you share the same values, you see what's wrong and what's okay in the same way, and that means that you're likely to get along. And then lastly, when things get tough, it's just much nicer to spend time with someone who can make jokes about it than someone who can. And it's very clear that social support matters a lot when it comes to health and wellness. And then lastly, and I think this is most related to a benign violation approach, is that to be able to create comedy out of tragedy not only creates positive emotion, helps rally people around us, but it can change the way we think about a tragedy. So to take the violations in the world and to make them benign and to make us and others laugh not only changes how we feel, it changes what we think about that tragedy. And so for the Humor Code Project, Joel and I went to New York, and we met with one of the head writers for The Onion. The Onion's a satirical newspaper. And in the days and weeks after 9/11, I don't know how much of you remember this, but there was very little laughter in this country, and there was very little comedy. And about 2 weeks after the 9/11 attacks, the Onion dedicated an entire issue to 9/11, and most people would say too soon in that situation, and any comedians in the house will agree with my friend Alonzo Bowden's statement, which is, it's not too soon if it's funny. And The Onion did something that I think that we could all learn a lesson from. And they didn't make fun of the victims. They made fun of the terrorists. So one of their headlines was, "Terrorists awaken and surprised to find themselves in hell." And The Onion's fax machine, this is the day of fax machines, the fax machine blew up and people thanking them for introducing laughter back into their lives. And I think that particular issue was really useful because what it did was, it didn't just create this positive emotion, but it just made these terrorists a lot less scary. And I think that that's what good comedy does, is it unites people in a way that that says, you aren't so bad. We can handle you. And I think that if you can take that into your own personal life, you can end up having a lot of these very useful benefits of humor. Thank you very much.
I want to look at this part where you said, when my boss, you know, the awkward, polite laughter, when my boss tells a joke that's not really funny, and then you looked right at me.